Okay, so first, of course, thank you to the organizers for inviting me out. They've asked me to give a talk that presents an overview of Kerklof's explosion mechanisms. So obviously, the scope that that title implies is extremely broad, and so I thought I'd start out with sort of listing things that I won't be presenting. So I will not be going through a history of models that just don't work, no reason to dwell on the past. I won't be talking about extremely rapidly rotating models, though they're interesting. I won't be talking about sort of less well-understood models. So these include the acoustic mechanism from Burrows et al. 2006, jittering jets from Noam Soker, or thermonuclear-driven Kerklof explosions as described by Kushnir and Katz. I won't be talking about extremely massive stars, so certainly not crazy 50,000 solar mass things, but also not the more sort of mundane supermassive stars that give rise to things like pulsational parent stability supernovae, as Stan's going to talk about. And I will not be giving a comprehensive account of everything, even on the topics that I talk about, so apologies if I miss your favorite point about Kerklof. And of course, I will not be presenting an unbiased viewpoint. Okay, so the first thing that I thought we should maybe do is just take a second to sort of set the stage for the discussion of the mechanisms that we're going to get to. And so this basically describes the process of collapse. So in some sense, the problem of Kerklof supernovae really picks up where stellar evolution stops. And at that point, the core, oxygen and magnesium core, and iron core, whatever it happens to be, has already gone gravitationally unstable and started to collapse. And along this collapse, there's various kinds of milestones having to do with neutrinos and how they're deleptonizing the system, neutrino trapping, various interesting phenomena that emerge, but for the sake of time, we'll just jump to the sort of the punchline of the story, which is that this core collapses all the way down beyond, in fact, nuclear densities. And if there's one thing we know about nuclei, the equation of state effectively is extremely stiff. And so when this happens, the collapse abruptly halts and, in fact, overshoots its sort of stable hydrostatic equilibrium and rebounds. And it's this bounce that launches an extremely strong acoustic wave, which effectively immediately steepens into a shock that then starts to propagate out into the still collapsing stellar material. So two things happen, which depending on your perspective are really great because it makes this interesting problem that we can solve, or really horrible because it ends up making the problem really hard. And those two things are that as the shock propagates out, the gas behind the shock is going to cool profusely through neutrino emission. And the second thing that happens is that the material that's falling down through the shock is, of course, made of nuclei. These are iron group elements, and eventually silicon and oxygen and so on. And when they go through the shock, they're going to encounter a MeV sort of range temperature plasma, and of course, a bath of MeV photons that are capable of dissociating these nuclei. And so that is exactly what happens. You photodissociate into neutrons, protons, alphas, things of this sort. And obviously, that comes at the expense of the thermal energy. So it turns out that those two things combined are actually sufficient to stall the shock. So what does that mean? It means, of course, the shock is still moving out in a Lagrangian sense. It's still plowing through mass as the star is collapsing. But in an Eulerian sense, in the lab frame, the shock actually stops moving out in radius. And that happens roughly around 150 kilometers or so. So this sort of sets the stage. We now have a protoneutron star that's inflated because it's nice and hot. It's something like, say, 60 or 70 kilometers in size. On top of that is a subsonic accretion flow that's sort of just continuing to feed the growth of this protoneutron star that's bounded by an accretion shock. And then outside of that, of course, we still have the more or less free-falling stellar material that's collapsing down. So the central question in Kerklof theory now is how do we, by what process, do we reinvigorate the shock so that it can propagate out to the rest of the star and lead to the sort of fireworks that people in this room spend time trying to observe. So for the sake of this discussion, again, I had to sort of reduce the scope somewhat, so I'm going to focus in on two mechanisms, and really I'll spend more time on this one than on this one, but this is an interesting mechanism, so I'll talk about it first. So this is the so-called MHD mechanism of Kerklof explosions, and it has excuse me, several key ingredients. So the first is that, of course, you have to have rapid differential rotation, and the second is that you have to have magnetic fields. And so specifically, what it really requires are large-scale colloidal fields that are extremely strong, something like 10 to the 15 Gauss fields. So these are magnetar-class fields that we need. Obviously, like I just said, requires a rapidly rotating protoneutron star, and it gives rise to these so-called jet-driven explosions is the jet-driven MHD mechanism that may be the sort of progenitor of hypernovae, so these extremely luminous supernova events, or extremely energetic supernova events. And the last point that I wanted to make is just that these are thought to be rare. They may make up, say, 1% or so of the overall supernova population. Okay, so the MHD mechanism has a long history. It goes all the way back to the 70s. The basic idea is actually really simple, which is just that if you have a rapidly differentially rotating core, there's a lot of free energy in differential rotation that you can tap into in principle to drive an explosion. And magnetic fields are one obvious way in which you could tap into that energy reservoir. So one thing that becomes clear pretty quickly, though, is that you need a really significant field amplification. So we had this discussion yesterday about the magnetic field strengths and massive star cores. I think there's still a fair amount of uncertainty surrounding that. But if you just say that the field strengths are something like 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 9 Gauss, which are field strengths that people typically talk about, it turns out that even though you'll amplify those fields through compression and through winding from differential rotation, those two amplification factors are just not enough to get you to the, say, 10 to the 15 Gauss scale fields that you need. And so you need some other mechanism to amplify these fields. And so in 2003, Akiyama et al. Suggested that the magnetorotational instability may be a means and may obtain in these conditions and actually lead to significant field amplification that can get you up to the 10 to the 15 Gauss fields. In 2006, Uzdensky and McFadden proposed this model of MHD-driven explosions that relied on these so-called magnetic towers. And the idea is basically you have these sort of collimated magnetic structures along the rotation axis that essentially act like a spring. And so as you pile up more and more the coils into the spring, that you just end up pushing the shock out in that fashion. So just a year later, Burroughs et al. Actually carried out the first simulations of this sort of process with a sort of a modern supernova code in the sense that it had, you know, realistic, so to speak, equation of state. It had neutrino transport and things like this. So they basically did a normal supernova calculation, but they also incorporated magnetic fields and rapidly differentially rotating cores. And what emerged from that are things like this picture here that's shown, which looks an awful lot like the sort of magnetic tower-like structures that Uzdensky and McFadden had suggested. So that's basically what they found, is they found, in fact, quite robust explosions that are powered in this very collimated sort of bipolar fashion. So being the first simulations of their kind, obviously they came with limitations, as all simulations come with limitations. And in this case, the big limitations were that they had to start with artificially large fields. These are fields that are like 10 to the 11 Gauss initially, for example. And that's basically because they have no means other than through compression and through just winding of the fields to amplify these field strengths, which is basically because of this reason, which is that they had inadequate resolution to actually model the MRI. And so they had no other means to amplify the fields. They had to start with large ones so that you get interesting fields at the end. So it's clearly a limitation. And the second limitation here is that these were axisymmetric calculations, and so there's a whole range of modes that you're just not subject to. And so there's questions about stability of this jet, whether or not the jet would persist in this sort of nice ordered fashion when you go to 3D. So lo and behold, people have done this now. So Philip Mosta et al. In 2014 basically redid the same study that Burroughs et al. Did with slightly less sophisticated neutrino transport, but at this time they did it in full 3D. And what they found was this shown in this picture here. So in 2D, you get this nice, clear, bipolar, nice ordered structure that emerges. In 3D, it turns out that this jet is in fact unstable. And they attributed this to an n equals 1 kink mode that can destabilize the jet. And so instead of these nice, clear, bipolar, collimated outflows, they instead puffed up these big lobes of magnetically buoyant material. And so you end up basically still injecting a lot of power, but now over a larger solid angle. And so you don't get nice boreholes like this, you get these big lobes instead. So they actually were not able to run their simulation long enough to produce an explosion. It looked quite promising. These are extremely expensive calculations to carry out. So I would say at this point, they didn't get an explosion, but it certainly looked like it was headed in that direction. Okay, so back to this question about how we actually can get to these magnetar scale fields. So there's obviously multiple parts to this question. The first is one we've already had a discussion about at some level, which is what are the initial field's strengths, and also what are the topology? What is the topology of this initial field? I think these are both important questions that we just don't know. Through compression and winding, we can amplify whatever these initial fields are, by maybe a factor of maybe a few thousand. And so if you start with fields, say, 10 to the 9 Gauss, we're talking about fields after the thing has collapsed of maybe, say, 10 to the 12, a few times 10 to the 12, which is, of course, a far cry from the 10 to the 15 Gauss fields that we need in order to drive these explosions. So Philip Mosta, again, 2015 now, they decided to take their simulations that they had run and just pound them with resolution. So they zoomed way in and had resolution, I think, down to 50 meters, in fact. So the sort of normal resolution in a supernova calculation is an order of magnitude larger than that. So these are extremely challenging calculations to carry out. But what they were looking for is some sign that the MRI, in fact, obtained under these conditions and that it led to some measurable field amplification. And that's exactly what they found. So these are different components of the B field showing their strength versus time. And this is sort of a maximum quantity, so it's the maximum strength of the B field versus time. And these different lines are actually just different resolutions. And so as they ramped up the resolution, they found that they were amplifying the fields more robustly. And so sure enough, MRI seems to be activated, at least in this particular model that they ran. It does seem capable of amplifying the fields at some level, but the question still remains, if you start out with weak fields, something like 10 to the 12 Gauss, can you actually manage to amplify those fields sufficiently to get you up to strengths that can actually power an explosion? And there's various effects that can come in that might limit the growth of these fields in the MRI. So there's neutrino effects, there's been work on how that may play a role. There's parasitic modes that show up that may limit the growth, just saturate the growth of the MRI. And so there's lots of open questions, lots of work still going on in this area. And so the upshot, basically, for the MHD mechanism is that I think all the evidence suggests that this is a viable mechanism, that it certainly can work. There's lots of energy, as I said, to tap into. Magnetic fields are certainly a good way to do that. But the question remains, how do we end up with these strong, large-scale, poloidal fields that are required to drive these explosions? This is still an open question. I'm sorry?
Less than a millisecond.
What's less than a millisecond? Oh, here. So, I mean, that's a good question. It's just the time scale is basically this the shear time. So it depends on your initial conditions and whatever model you.
It's not even a single winding, right?
Yeah, it's just that's the growth rate. It's super. It's just really rapid. So, and this is not going through, many e-foldings here, right? I mean, this is. The amplification here is maybe it's less than a factor of 10 amplification that they found. Okay, so much for the MHD mechanism. Let's move on and talk about everyone's favorite, the neutrino mechanism. I want to spend the rest of my time actually talking about this. So in this, for the sake of this talk, and this is maybe a crude distinction, I'll be talking really about slowly rotating models that end up being powered by neutrino absorption in a particular layer. All right, so what is the basic idea? So the idea is that there's just a lot of neutrinos around, right? So you've got neutrinos diffusing out of this hot protoneutron star. You've got neutrinos that are emitted in the gas that's accreting on and just sort of cooling and settling onto the protoneutron star. And those neutrinos, as they try to escape from the system, can interact with material that's just behind the shock. They can heat it up. That can give rise to these violent hydrodynamic motions that we'll see, things like convection and so on, which can play an interesting role. And it's thought that together all these processes can lead to reinvigorating the shock and driving an explosion. And this is thought to make up sort of the garden variety supernova. This is the bulk of the supernovae that we observe. So Tomas in 2001 produced this nice little diagram that just illustrates what I just described. So it's a nice picture to keep in the back of your head. It's nice and clean. So we've got accretion. This is just the stellar material just collapsing down basically in free fall. We've got this accretion shock, which at this point now has just stalled, so it's just sitting there, not doing anything interesting. We've got this region here. This is the region that I just referred to where there's actually net heating due to the absorption of neutrinos that are emitted beneath it in both this cooling layer where the material is cooling off and settling onto the protoneutron star, and also from neutrinos that bounce around in the protoneutron star and eventually diffuse out. And so this is the basic picture, and there's lots of interesting phenomena that come out and that we'll talk about in just a minute. There's these arrows indicated, so I feel compelled to mention them. Things like overturn, so this is the sort of convection that might show up in this region. There's even instabilities down here in the core that can lead to overturn. So this is a nice cartoon. What goes into sort of modern supernova models? So the models, I think, these days have gotten pretty sophisticated in terms of the physics that they treat and the fidelity with which they treat them. But there's lots of ingredients that go in, so it's worth just sort of listing them. So initial conditions are obviously something that we would require. We take them from stellar evolution modelers. So we have models from Stan, for example, and Alex and others that we just sort of map into our codes. I'd say these are still there's still a fair amount of uncertainty, both not just in the 1D profiles of things like density and entropy and so on, but also in the sort of multidimensional structure. So I think there's a growing appreciation that these stars in their late stages are undergoing pretty violent burning stages, and that may lead to significant perturbations from spherical symmetry. And so there's some efforts now to try to incorporate that, but those are, again, still uncertain. So the initial conditions are an important ingredient. They set the stage for everything, but they're still a large source of uncertainty for these core collapse models. Self-gravity is sort of obvious. These days, to be competitive, you really need some kind of treatment of relativistic effects. No one is really doing full GR with all the other physics, all the sophisticated neutrino transport and all these things. Approximate GR, and I can tell you what that means if you're really dying to know, but some form of inclusion of relativistic effects, I think people agree, is important to do. Hydrodynamics, obviously, a nuclear equation of state, obviously. Again, though, there's uncertainty, and in fact, of recent years, there's been sort of an explosion of new equation of state tables that people can use for supernova calculations, and so I think there's efforts going on right now to sort of explore the consequences of that. There, of course, you need multiple dimensions. We just talked about this overturn. You're not going to get that in 1D. Three-flavor multi-group neutrino transport is sort of the standard. Of course, there are six flavors of neutrinos, but the mus and taus and their entities all have sort of similar interaction cross-sections. And so just for computational expediency's sake, we lump them all together into one, and we have three species to solve. So now we've got, instead of six transport equations to solve, we only have three. Hooray. And finally, we have an exhaustive list of neutrino matter interactions. There's quite a few interactions that come into this problem. And so we have now quite a long list of interactions that we include. And I think that's there's been actually progress on this sort of stuff even just recently. The last thing I'll mention here, of course, is there's still large uncertainties in the neutrino matter interactions. And given that the neutrinos are sort of the agents of explosion, this is obviously a big uncertainty that we care about quite a lot. So what happens now when we take these models and we turn on all these different pieces of physics? Clearly, the cartoon that we've got here, which is extremely useful from the perspective of sort of forming a picture in your head that you can keep with you, keep close to your heart. When you turn all this physics on, things get messy. And that's sort of, I think everyone appreciates this fact. But I think from these simulations, there's been a lot of them at this point, you can extract, I think, some list of things that I think are generically important in the supernova phenomena. And so here's just a list, and it's maybe not even a complete list, but it's certainly at least a list. So the first thing, and the most obvious thing when we watch a movie in just a second here, is instabilities. And so instabilities play a major role in the dynamics of supernovae. And this goes back to work from Beta in 1990, for example, who suggested that convection was obviously going to play an important role in this problem. And so we're just sort of confirming that kind of thinking. So there's neutrino-driven convection. That's one kind of instability that's driven by neutrino heating. There's another kind of instability, the standing accretion shock instability, which is, I'm sure Terry will tell us all about the standing accretion shock instability tomorrow's talk. So I won't dwell on this, but this is another interesting instability that gives rise to all sorts of interesting sort of oscillatory-like phenomena that we, in fact, will see in just a moment. There's doubly diffusive instabilities in the protoneutron star. So these are instabilities that are around because there's a stable entropy gradient but an unstable composition gradient. And so turnover in the core can be important. There's obviously associated with all these instabilities, there's turbulent stresses and turbulent transport of various quantities. That I think people recognize now to be an important ingredient in the problem. The idea that there's neutrino spheres, I think, obviously is important. And in particular, what's important really is sort of the temperatures of these neutrino spheres, because at the end of the day, the neutrino matter interaction cross sections scale something like energy squared. And so if you can make the neutrino sphere hotter, you'll get a harder spectrum, and that coupling between the neutrinos and the matter that you're trying to heat will be more efficient. And so understanding the neutrino spheres, and of course that they depend on energy because of this dependence on energy in the cross-section, are important ingredients in models. And finally, neutron star contraction plays an interesting role and actually has lots of sort of competing impacts on the problem. So one, for example, as the neutron star contracts, you're sort of taking away, in some sense, the pressure support of the material that's sitting on top of it, which is, of course, not conducive to explosion. But on the other hand, as the thing compresses, you're also heating up the neutrino spheres, which gives you a harder spectrum, and that sort of thing obviously leads to more efficient heating and is conducive to explosions. It also plays an interesting role, in fact, in picking out which of these instabilities is sort of the dominant one in town. It turns out that, we'll see in a minute, that the sort of size of the region between the shock and the neutron star has important consequences for the sorts of instabilities that obtain. Okay, so I said I wasn't going to go through a long history, and I'm certainly not going through a long history, but I did feel compelled to mention these works here in the early to mid-90s, of which Tomas, who's right over there and we'll talk next, certainly played an important role in. So these were really sort of the foundational works, I think, from which we all sort of are still growing. And the reason for that is that these were the first numerical models of neutrino-driven explosions that really emphasized the importance of these multidimensional instabilities of convection and things of this sort. So they very much set the stage for the work that's going on still today. We're still trying to understand in detail all these processes that come to pass. So since that work has sort of been this the inevitable slow march of progress, right? So we're producing new progenitors. We've gone from gray transport to multi-group transport. I think that was an important advance, and it certainly made our calculations slower. we've incorporated relativistic effects, and I think there's sort of a better appreciation for the importance and all the trade-offs that come with those relativistic effects. There's been improvements and certainly a lot of thought, at least about neutrino matter interaction cross-sections. And in particular, I think what we've done is incorporated sort of a more complete set of these interactions in many of the supernova codes. Obviously, resolution has gone up, and the dot, dot, dot is meant to just indicate, you know, lots of small incremental improvements over the years. So, brief history. okay, so for this talk, I'm going to focus basically exclusively on this sort of rich set of two-dimensional axisymmetric models that are now being produced by a number of groups around the world. And as you'll see, I think actually we're reaching, I don't want to say a consensus, because that's certainly not exactly the case. But I think we're in better agreement now than I think we have historically been in. And so I think that constitutes progress, as I think we'll see. So, okay, finally, I'll show you an actual simulation of one of these things. So what does it actually look like? This is a simulation that we ran of a 20 solar mass model that is actually from Woosley and Hager, 2007. And there's a whole lot of things that I would love to point out. Of course, what do I have, 8 minutes, 7 minutes? So, six and a half, you're killing me. Okay, so the first thing I want to do is tell you what you're looking at. So this is actually two different simulations. There's one here and there's one here. The top panel, this is showing entropy. The bottom panel is the so-called pressure contrast. It's basically like grad P over P. It just highlights interesting features in the flow. And the first thing that you'll notice if you look at it just right now is these models are clearly exploding. The scale here is something like, it's 500 kilometers here, so it's 1,000 kilometers across the whole box. So these are exploding models. There's interesting phenomena that emerge. I mentioned the SASE. So here you have the stalled accretion shock. It basically looks perfectly spherical, but pretty soon here, right there, you'll see it starts to oscillate, and you get this interesting oscillatory behavior. It's a hallmark of the SASE. So clearly in this 20 solar mass model, we see the growth of the SASE, I think, at early times. What happens next is an utter mess, and I think it's difficult, especially in this 2D context, to disentangle exactly if it's the SASE or convection or whatever. It doesn't much matter in the nonlinear phase. The point is it's wildly turbulent. So why are there two simulations? They're basically identical simulations, but in this one, we've modified one of the interaction cross-sections somewhat, by some amount. And it's motivated by this work that Chuck Horowitz just put out recently. How much? It's not a large correction. I forget actually the numbers, to be honest. So, anyway, it's not a large correction, but the point is that there's some correction in one piece of physics in this big integrated calculation, and you can already see that there are differences. So what changed in this model? Here, well, it turns out what's going on is that what we've done effectively is lowered, actually, the cross-section. The one that's important is we lowered the scattering cross-section of the heavy-type neutrinos, which then are allowed to diffuse out of the protoneutron star faster, which leads to core contraction of this protoneutron star. And that basically just shrinks the whole system, right, which makes the timescales for growth of these things like the SASE faster, and so you see the growth of it just show up earlier than this one. So the interesting thing that happens, though, is as I mentioned before, how core contraction is an important ingredient here. And this is something that Tomas points out all the time, that core contraction is a crucial piece of this puzzle. So in this model, the core contracts faster because of these losses from the heavy type neutrinos. And so the consequence of that is that, again, like I said before, you end up with higher neutrinospheric temperatures for the other species, which then couple more efficiently to the region where there's net heating and end up driving explosions earlier. So this is the difference between the two models. Otherwise, the same progenitor, same code. There's no changes except for this one cross section. So, but they both explode.
Do they both stop growing in mass?
It's not totally obvious. It certainly doesn't appear that they've stopped growing in mass at this point. So they're not carried out all that long either. So certainly the mass accretion rate drops, but it has not been cut off. I mean, this model in particular, you have this long-lived sort of funnel of material coming in on the side. Okay, so this is the same kind of plot, so I don't have to go through it again, but now instead of a 20 solar mass progenitor, we have a 9 solar mass progenitor. So this is a much lower mass progenitor star. This is work that's presented in Radice et al. From our group. And you see the same sort of phenomena. Again, there are explosions in both of these models, so this is a theme. We get explosions. Many groups now are getting explosions, as we'll see in just a second in 2D. Can't we just be happy with progress? okay, so moving right along. One of the interesting things that I wanted to point out in this model is that the progenitor structure is different, and what that translates into that's important in this particular comparison is the accretion rate is different, and so this is the lower accretion rate given the 9 solar mass model, so it's not quite as compressed as the 20 solar mass model, and when you see the growth of the instabilities early on, you may hopefully have noticed, because I'm not going to wait until this plays again, it was not an oscillatory growth. Instead, you see these mushrooms show up, which is a sure sign that we're really sort of driving this thing by neutrino-driven convection. Okay, so these calculations at this point actually have gotten surprisingly affordable. So we're actually in a position where we can run lots and lots and lots of models, which is great because we can finally start to study some of the sort of systematic effects that come along with various aspects of this problem. So here's just a collection of runs for four different progenitors where we're basically just changing the neutrino matter interactions, the ones that we include, various corrections to certain opacities and so on. And what you see is that we get explosions. We get explosions pretty robustly in this particular set, which is just some particular combination of physics with corrections to certain cross sections and so on. We get some explosions in other models, and then some models don't explode. So we get a whole range of behaviors. And I think what this plot really highlights, at least in my mind, none of these changes, by the way, are changes to sort of dominant processes in any respect, right? These are certainly important processes in the sense that clearly varying them has an effect, but they're not dominant processes. And so the fact that there's such an effect, I think, is what it's telling us really is that we're really right at the threshold of explosion, right? So we're like standing on the edge of a cliff, and depending on the direction of the gust of wind, we may fall over the precipice and explode, or we may just be knocked on our butts and cry. Okay, so we get explosions. I had to plot it. Explosion energies. So these are from those four sort of robustly exploding models that I just showed. By the way, I should have mentioned these are 12, 15, 20, and 25 solar mass models. So we measure the explosion energy. This energy scale over here is 10 to the 50 ergs, and the highest energy that we get at the end of the calculation that we followed was something like 6 times 10 to the 50 ergs. So that is not 10 to the 51 ergs. That's not our canonical explosion, but it's pretty damn close. Come on.
There is no canonical
explosion. No, I mean, of course not. Everyone talks about...
The number is 60, 50, and not 10.
Well, then, thank you. We nailed it. Problem solved. Yes. Anyway, the point is that we do get explosion energies that are sort of in the ballpark, at least. That was the point. Whether or not we get exactly the right distribution of explosion energies, I think, is actually not even that interesting, because, in fact, there's still quite a lot of uncertainties in these models, and so, you know, the specifics of things like explosion energy are actually not something that I expect to be sort of, you know, written in stone by any stretch. Okay, so we're not the only ones to get explosions, of course. So this is actually just a different set of progenitors, but from our same groups and same calculations. I'm almost there. So this is a set of models that look like electron capture-like supernovae. These are lower mass stars that have steeper density profiles. This is on a log scale, which is why these look a little funny. But we certainly get explosions. In fact, we get explosions even in 1D for some of these models, which is just the nature of these electron capture-like supernovae. Oxygen and magnesium core collapse events. So that's one set of progenitors. So this is from the Garkin group. This is Bernhard Müller's work. They find explosions for several models. This is Suma et al., also from the Garkin group. They find explosions for a whole range of progenitor stars. And this is not actually just a subset of the models that they produced in this paper. This is from the Oak Ridge group, also finding explosions for all the four models they looked at, which, by the way, is the same set that we were just talking about for Mars, the 12, 15, 20, and 25 solar mass models. So these are all axisymmetric, that's right. So 2D is where we have lots of results. 3D, we are starting, in the sense of the community, are starting to produce results. Tomas will talk all about that, which is why I decided to not touch too much on that. Okay, so I showed our results for the 12, 15, 20, 25. Bruin et al. Have also produced results for 12, 15, 20, 25, and also the Garkin group. So we have actually the same set of progenitors with nominally the same sorts of physics, and we can actually just directly compare now in terms of shock radius versus time, which is maybe not the best way to compare, in fact, but this is a plot that we're all familiar with looking at. There's actually some of these models between our group and the Garkin group actually agree amazingly well, in fact, on when explosion actually is inaugurated. Same exact progenitors, yeah. But overall, I'd say there's actually reasonable agreement, qualitatively at least, and so there's obviously quantitative disagreements that we need to understand, lots of work ahead of us, but I think this is actually really a major sign of progress, which is my first point in the summary here, which is there really has been, I think, a fair amount of progress in recent years. The groups are really, I think, starting to get to the point where we're kind of agreeing on certain things, which is great. But even though we get explosions, and we get explosions that are essentially perfect, right, 6 times 10 to the 50, this is the number. I think the problem is, of course, far from solved. There are many, many things that we want to produce in terms of predictions from our models before we can declare the thing sort of understood. You know, there's things like not just explosion energies, but also nucleosynthetic yields, light curves, properties of the neutron stars and black holes left behind, like the mass distributions, their kick velocities, yada, yada, yada. There's lots and lots of things, and we're very far from producing all that. 3D modeling obviously is a feature. Tomas will talk about that. I'm curious to find out. So I had this paper in 2013 where we did very crude modeling of this thing, but it was in 3D, and one of the phenomena that emerged is the emergence of these large bubbles that seem to drive explosion, and I'm dying to know if, in fact, when you run the full thing, if the same kind of phenomena emerge. In that context, initial conditions are a major uncertainty. People have started doing these full 3D models of burning in late stages, as Sean Couch's work, etc. I was done. So.
For one question. Just kidding. I know, I'm just kidding.
Look, mine says 33 minutes. I was 3 minutes over. Come on.
So we heard yesterday about a lot of interest in whether 25 solar mass stars actually explode or not, or produce failed supernovae. So I take it from this that they might explode, they might not. It's sufficiently, you have some models that look like they nicely explode at 25 solar masses.
Yep.
But it's sufficiently on the precipice that you wouldn't put money one way or the other?
At this point, I would say that's the case. So I think we're making progress toward maybe answering that question at some point, but at this point, there's still enough uncertainties that you could kick things one way or the other, and I think it's just not clear yet.
In the meantime, I have a question actually to follow up on something Elliot alluded to. Some of the movies looked like they continued to accrete significantly after they were already exploding.
And that's an important, actually, part of the
problem.
So what
about the masses of the neutron stars that you're getting?
So, I mean, you got to follow these things until accretion stops. In fact, some would argue that you have to follow them to very late times to get all the fallback accretion and all the stuff that might produce more massive remnants. And so I don't know exactly how this ends. You have to just run these simulations longer. I think the mass, if you look at the mass, though, it's the growth of it has slowed down quite a lot. And so I think it's sort of settling out at reasonable numbers.
Is it higher than you might want at the times where you can capture it? Or is it
It's a good question. So that's really a question about the sort of the distribution of masses, and we just don't have access to that kind of thing yet. So I'm not sure how to really answer that well.
So actually, also following up on this, does it matter much whether your star still has an envelope, or is that completely irrelevant for the purposes of explodability?
It's essentially completely irrelevant. Yeah, so I mean, there's almost no binding energy in the envelope anyway, and so it doesn't really even contribute to sort of energy at infinity or anything like that, and it certainly doesn't come in on the timescales that we're looking at into play in actually producing explosions in terms of the mechanism. So I think it's largely irrelevant.
So for the masses, you do at least have the mass at the moment when your shock is finally getting out.
Yeah.
So are those masses, I guess the question is, you have access to that mass number?
I'm pretty sure we plot it. I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head.
Okay.
But yes, but certainly we can measure it. And
for you, that would be a minimum, at least at that point in the simulation,
they're
right?
They're very different from the iron core masses.
So the number that's jumping out of my head is something like 1.5 solar masses, but that's a very...
They're close to the iron core masses that systematics has been studying, and they're in good agreement with observation.
Right. There hasn't been much additional mass added.
Gravitation.
Right.
Yes, these are baryonic masses, by the way, the 1.5.
To follow up on Ilya's question, you said that envelopes not matter whether you are going to explode the star or not. Does it affect the amount of possible fallback mass and the mass of the compact object that you create?
I wouldn't think. I don't know the answer, of course. I mean, I'd have to study that in detail. But the fact that there's not much binding energy there would suggest that it's not going to be a significant player in producing, in determining what mass ends up falling back, and rather than being bound, or bound or unbound. That question, I think it's.
That canonical 60-50 number, you just have to beware of what explosion energy means.
Mm-hmm.
I think the number that Stan is referring to, and what I was giving you a thumbs up for, is really more on the observational end of things, where it's the kinetic energy at infinity of the ejecta.
Yep.
So it's a one-to-one mapping to your well-defined explosion energy is probably not there. There's a fair amount of wiggle room to push it one way or the other.
I think that's a fair statement. So yeah.
Don't get too excited.
No, did I look excited? Well, it was positive. Yeah. So there's of course a range, and the Crab may have been one of these sort of electron capture like low mass progenitor stars, and we tend to find lower supernova energies for those models.
Since there's a moment, I'll make a quick historical comment that only the old guys I would care about, and that is the idea of convection making the explosion go was Jim Wilson. And Hans Bethe worked with Jim, and he got it to explode in a 1D code, but he used mixing link theory for the convection.
All right.
Can we go back to the magnetic towers? I mean, I know that wasn't what you emphasized, but I don't know if there's going to be more talk about that from Thomas.
I don't think so.
No. So if you go back to the...
You want to go back to the slide?
Yeah, back to the MOSTA. I guess their final answer in 3D...
You want this one?
Well, whatever. Yeah, maybe that was that their final punchline, or was there a follow-up?
This one?
Yeah, that one. So I think there were some questions. So maybe it would be good to talk a little bit about this growth rate. I think there was some confusion about how you can get a rapid growth rate. I think you answered it, which is its differential rotation. But I think for some, it might have been a surprise because it's on a border. The dynamical time was shorter. But you should maybe amplify why that's not the right number.
Well, so it's really the shear time scale. I mean, there are people in the room who are far more expert even than I in the MRI, Elliot, for example. But this is, it's really the shear time scale. I mean, the MRI grows on very rapid time scales, and given the rapid rotation rates in these cores, which are, I mean, the spin periods here are roughly a millisecond in these cores, so they're extremely rapidly rotating. So given that, you know, this growth rate is actually not surprising. It's why these simulations are even possible, in fact. I didn't mention this, but this whole time scale for this whole entire simulation, which was extremely expensive, is something like 10 milliseconds. So the expectation was, in fact, that they'd grow on that time scale, and that's what was found.
So one more comment on this. If you go back to the previous slide, if they do simulations with a larger initial magnetic field, they do get a nice jet that gets out. So I think it's not that the 3D models mean you cannot have nice, clean, jet-powered supernovae. It means you need a significantly factor of 10 larger magnetic field to do it in 3D than in 2D.
That's a good point.
Okay, Thomas, you want to start getting set up? Let's thank Josh again if there are no other questions.